San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening. Welcome to It's Your Money and Your Life. I am Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from KFMB Studios in Kearney Mesa with 50,000 watts of power. We're being heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up to Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my illustrious co-host. He's a marathon runner. He's a family office advisor to several high net worth families. He's a core member of STAR San Diego, Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable. All around good guy, CPA extraordinaire, Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. I'm just glad I'm here. I thought I was going to be calling in from San Jose.
Yeah, you spent a few days, up in Big Sur?
Well, flew into San Jose, then drove down to Big Sur because I ran the Big Sur River 10K yesterday, which I always do every year. It's the best-smelling road race in the country because you smell, campfires and redwood trees that you're running underneath, and then you run over the Big Sur River.
Wow.
It's really incredible. So anyway, driving back up to San Jose, you know, you get the email and the phone call you don't want to get because you're already on the road, which is your 150 flight's been delayed to 4 due to mechanical issues. Mm-hmm. But they're not sure if it's really 4 or not. They just think it might be.
And you've got a 7 p.m. radio program.
Yeah, and we brought a couple of clients of UBS and mine. We won't mention their names on the air for confidentiality, but so I had to pick them up at 6. And so I'm like, 4 o'clock flight? They're not even sure if we're going to get out on time? Are you kidding me?
Well,
And so when I got there, noticed they had a 3:30 to San Diego, and they had one seat left, so they moved me, since I'm such a radio star.
Yeah,
yeah, right. Moved me onto the 3:30. And so, of course, it's 3 o'clock, and they're not even mentioning boarding the 3:30 yet. And the guy goes, well, the crew hasn't shown up yet for the 3:30.
Oh, that's nice.
I'm like, the crew hasn't shown up yet? This is Southwest, in case anybody's wondering.
You could fly it, Richard, if you had to, right?
Yeah, I could fly it if I had to, but I don't want
anyway,
to. I'm not used to things that big, but... So the crew was coming from another flight and got in late. And so we got out at about 4, left the family up there, but they got out at about 4:30. So now they're in, and here I am.
We'll try to book those flights a little earlier in the day next time, Richard.
Oh, 150, come on. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, usually in the, California airports, it's bad weather. I mean, it's like 80 degrees and sunny in San Jose. It's like, what could possibly go wrong? There wasn't even any fog in San Francisco in terms of a connecting flight.
Yeah. Well, speaking of bad weather, it's October 28th. I just want to timestamp this show because we're expecting this huge mega storm to hit the East Coast, and that looks pretty daunting. They're expecting up to 40-foot waves and 75-mile-an-hour winds, and they're evacuating the, several million people, right?
It's going to be huge, apparently. And, the New York City Marathon's next Sunday.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they're going to... Well, it depends how much damage, I guess, whether they can even run that thing.
The mayor of New York's expecting a lot of power to get knocked out, and the stock market's closed tomorrow, which doesn't happen all that often. It's kind of a crazy day.
So hopefully the predictions for that weather aren't as bad as what the weather actually turns out to be, because that does not sound pretty.
Yeah, thank God it wasn't next week, election week, because that would really throw off results, I would think. So, but anyway, I brought you a gift, Richard. I did make it out to Allegiance at the Old Globe Thursday night. What a great musical. It had a successful run. They had to extend it, but they obviously ran out of, the other commitments for shows, so they couldn't extend it anymore. But this show is going to go to Broadway next fall, they believe, and I picked up an extra program for you. So congratulations to them and everybody, George Takei. And we're going to have actually Wendy Gillespie, one of the senior producers, on this show in January to talk all about the whole process of from concept to Broadway in three easy steps. So... Or however many it took, or so.
Maybe we can do the radio show from Broadway.
Well, maybe, or maybe, maybe from the Old Globe or something.
Yeah, or from the Old Globe. So I'm glad you enjoyed that. Yeah, I wanted to get out. I didn't realize it was over this week, and I had one of those weeks this week.
Well, it's an extraordinary show.
I was speaking all week to groups Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, then on an airplane.
Yeah, well, running and then on an airplane. So good for you. By the way, just real quickly, if anyone's looking for, if you're a DVD collector, this store called Completely Video. It's next to the original Estats in Adams Avenue there in Normal Heights. They're closing up shop in a few months, and I bought, I think, a dozen DVDs for $40 the other day. So go see James over there. He's a good guy, and they've got a lot of great recent DVDs if you're into that sort of thing. And congrats to Lestats, by the way, that was named Best Coffee House by San Diego City Beat Readers and Best in three or four other categories as well. So congrats to them. So anyway, Richard, we've got a great couple of shows coming up all about UBS, our premier sponsor. So why don't we get into it?
Yeah, here's a story. You know, the election is 9 days away. And so our next two shows are two of the brightest minds at UBS. Next week, Thomas McLaughlin, who was on a few months ago, he's going to be back talking about California bonds and other things. And, of course, tonight we have Michael Ryan all the way from the East Coast. He may not get back home on time this week because he's supposed to head back to the East Coast, I think Tuesday or Wednesday, and that's not a good time to be flying back east.
May I give his title, Richard?
Go ahead.
He's the chief he's a CFA, by the way, which is a pretty difficult credential to get. Not too many people have those, but he's chief investment strategist. He's head of wealth management research for the Americas. He's head of Wealth Management America's Investments Committee. Or he's on that committee, and he's here in studio. So, Mike, welcome to KFMB.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate being here.
Pleasure. What do you want to get into first, Richard?
Why are you out here? I'm just curious.
Well, I thought you invited me. What, now I'm not
did.
Welcome?
No, I invited you, and you're welcome. But what brings you out here besides business?
Well, first of all, my daughter actually is, she graduated from the University of San Diego, and she's now at grad school at San Diego State. And my mom-in-law happens to be in La Jolla, so I came in a day early. And fortunately, I did, because I have meetings tomorrow, as you mentioned, tomorrow, Tuesday, and Wednesday. If I hadn't left today, I might not have gotten here.
Yeah, I know.
My wife was just thrilled to see me leave just as the storm was arriving.
Yeah. Any kids back home? Or?
We have one other one, and she's a junior in college, and she's at Villanova outside of Philadelphia.
Okay.
But the rest of the year, you're in New York and on the East Coast, right?
I am.
Wow.
Well, hopefully things will go well, and the storm won't be as bad as it's sounding like it's going to be.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Anyway, should we get into his bio for a few minutes?
Yeah, read a few things about his bio.
We always liked it. Well, maybe you can
ask him a few questions.
Born and raised, education, things like that. We normally like to get into people's background at the top of the show. So, born where, schooled where, et cetera?
Born and raised in Queens, New York, so I'm a product of the city.
Okay.
And then went to both undergrad and grad school at the University of Rochester, upstate New York. Went to the Simon School got my MBA, and I'm still fortunate enough to be involved with the school in different capacities, including a board member of their business school.
Wow. Interesting.
And how do you get to be in the position that you're in UBS? Because to be the chief investment analyst, that sounds really important.
Yeah, what was your route, your professional route to your esteemed position now?
It was a long, arduous, and sometimes humbling route. let's face it, the markets have a way of humbling all of us.
How long have you been with UBS now?
It'll be in this next year, coming up next June, it'll be 29 years.
Wow. You don't look that old,
no,
my friend.
I was going to say.
I feel it, trust me.
So you're spending most of your time following the election?
We're obviously, if you're going to have an informed view about the real economy and financial markets today, there's no way you can't be discussing what's happening on the political side and also with regard to policy. Because so much of what's going to happen is going to be determined in political centers and by policy choices. So I've told people I've never seen an environment where what happens in terms of the real economy and financial markets hinges so much on the wisdom of policy choices or the will of political leaders.
And we can get into this in the show, but general question to start. Do you think things will look a lot different depending on whether Obama gets reelected or Romney gets elected?
Let's start with the fact that whoever wins, they're going to face the same set of problems. So it's not going to be a sudden restacking of the deck, and suddenly you're going to have the fiscal problems will disappear if someone's elected. I think the path they choose to tackle those problems will obviously differ. So, yeah, I do think the outcome matters, and I do think the pathway they follow will have an impact on how financial markets behave.
And I noticed in the material that you guys put out about the election about a month and a half ago, you were predicting that Obama would squeak by. Do you still believe that that might be the case, or do you feel that Romney's narrowed the gap to the point where nobody can even take a guess?
I think this is going to be one of those deals where Tuesday night we go to bed and we're not entirely certain who our president's going to be. It's going to be a really close call. I think there's going to be it's going to come down to a few states. We know that these 10 states are still in play. And it may come down to how Ohio falls is going to determine who the next president is.
And a month later, the Supreme Court will let us know. So.
Let's hope we don't see that again.
Okay. Well, yeah, we don't want to go through that. Do you think the Democrats are going to hang on in the Senate?
It's going to be one of these instances where whoever takes the White House will likely swing the Senate. It's probably going to be a 51-49 or 50-50. Mm-hmm. And if you think of it from that context, suppose it is 50-50. Then whoever wins the White House effectively gains control of the Senate because they cast a deciding vote.
Pro Tem gets the VP.
Right.
Yep. Interesting.
Well, it's not going to be dull, put it that way.
No.
It's not going to be dull. So with regard to following the election, as the chief investment strategist for UBS, are you sort of sitting in the sidelines in terms of what you might put forth to how you talk to your clients and how you talk to your advisors before the election versus after the election?
We do. Let's start with, first of all, people have asked me, you know, why does the outcome matter? Why why does the election matter? And I said, part of the reason the election matters is just to get it behind us. There's been so much uncertainty. There's been such inaction in Washington. We basically kicked the can down the road. We deferred things till after the election. We haven't addressed tax issues. We haven't addressed issues with regard to fiscal policy, spending issues. And at least after we get past the election, at least we can begin the process of having discussion of how we're going to deal with them. So if nothing else happens, just purely getting past Election Day, I think is going to be helpful because we'll get some clarity on these issues. We'll have a pathway through.
But there's still that gridlock issue. Whoever gets in there, right? I mean, you've got, well, you know, you've got a let's say the House maintains its Republican majority. With a Republican president, he's in a lot better shape to get things done, I would think.
Right? He is, but let's not forget that unless there's some radical outcome over the course of the next week or so, you're likely to get a Senate that's close to 50-50. So you're not going to get a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, no matter who wins.
Right.
So when you talk about, you know, divided government, it's still going to be divided because you do need 60-seat filibuster-proof majority to get any major substantial legislative initiatives through.
So let's start with then the fiscal cliff and sequestration, the Bush tax cut sunset. Obviously, what tax policy will look like going forward will depend a lot on who gets elected as president. But with regard to the timing of removing the uncertainty behind this, well, drastic change in tax rates between the end of the last day of this year and the first day of 2013, nothing's going to happen any faster whether Romney gets elected or the president gets reelected, right?
Well, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, you could see a situation where, and let's break this into two issues. There's the first, which is, as you mentioned, is the fiscal cliff. And that's kind of the issue we have to tackle right away. The other longer-term issues about fiscal reform and longer-term reform of the tax code, I think that will play out over the course of 2013, perhaps even 2014. But as you mentioned, Richard, we have a number of these provisions that are expiring, set to expire after December 31st. And if we don't address some of them, either extend some of the Bush tax cuts, you know, push back some of the spending cuts or the sequestrations you mentioned, you know, that represents about $550, $560 billion worth of stimulus. So in other words, think about, as Joe and I were talking earlier, you know, think about the impact of a stimulus package, the $780 billion stimulus package. That, by the way, was spread out about over 2 years. So think of the opposite of that. Think about $550 billion in tax cuts or in spending measures all coming due in 1 year. That's about 3.5% of GDP. That's a pretty significant shock to the economy. So I think the first thing is we need to get past this fiscal cliff. I'm not saying you extend everything, but I think we need to see an agreement, a short-term agreement at least, perhaps 6 to more preferably 12 months, where we extend most of these measures. So then we can sit down and have a serious discussion about how we're going to address our fiscal affairs.
So by most of the measures, you mean things like extending the estate tax rules for a year, capital gains are supposed to go from 15 to 20, tax on qualified dividends could go from 15 to 39.6 or actually 43.4.
Yeah. Richard, can you hold that thought, though? Because
I'm holding it in both hands, Joe.
Let's come back to that right after this break with It's Your Money and Your Life.
That's what we're called.
All right, we're back with It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Musio, myself, and UBS analyst Mike Ryan. Welcome back, everybody. Richard, your question was...
I wanted to point one thing out. The market isn't totally closed tomorrow. You can still do electronic transactions. Just nobody's going to be on the floor.
Right.
But my question to Michael Ryan was, to the extent that we have tax provisions that are expiring here in just under 2 months at 12/31/2012, what are the most important estate or income tax provisions that you think Congress should deal with immediately so that we don't have a disaster that uncertainty can cause?
Well, I think the first thing we're really going to have to deal with is simply the personal income tax, because you have to get some clarity on what the withholding is going to look like. And you know, otherwise, that immediately starts to draw right out of paychecks, and that has an economic bite. I think you do have to also deal with the capital gains and the dividend rates as well, because, again, if you're going to have a situation where, as you mentioned before, Richard, where the capital gains rates goes up, and then you also have the dividend income tax goes up as well, that could have an impact on financial markets. It could have an ability on impact on people's willingness to spend. So we have to be careful here, because if you start saying, okay, this tax provision, you get a little bit too granular about it. I think the broader issue is we should at least temporarily extend most of the tax measures until we can have a more thoughtful discussion about how we want to address these. Because I'm not a fan of making, 11th hour decisions with a gun at your head. I don't think those typically work very well.
Yeah, and so let me give you a hypothetical. Again, you can't give tax advice on the show, but so I get a call from a client last week who has a $700,000 gain in its stock position, and he says, well, I think the stock's pretty much run its course, but I normally wouldn't want to recognize a capital gain, but I see that the 15% capital gains rate might be 20% in 2013, plus another 3.8% for the so-called Obamacare tax, which is 23.8. He said, do you think I should sell it before the year ends? And I said, don't ask me. I'm not your congressman. My point was, I don't know what Congress is going to do, but I hate it when, as a CPA, I hate it when people make decisions that are, shall I say, heavily motivated by tax? Because this is something this person probably wouldn't do if we weren't having this discussion about what the capital gains rate was going to be next year. So it becomes very hard to advise somebody when there's this much uncertainty, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to make.
Any thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, look, I think you kind of nailed it in that I think this inability to kind of give people clarity about what the tax code is going to look like. And it's, by the way, it's not just the capital gains or the dividend income. It's across the board. Think about also about, corporate taxes. This inability to give them clarity means that people are sort of, paralyzed either into an action or making decisions that aren't economic decisions. They're based on a taxable issue. And that's when usually as investors, we tend to make our mistakes, is that we're driven by short-term tax issues rather than long-term fundamentals.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. And to me, I think that I told somebody the other day, I said, I don't really care what the tax code becomes as long as they give us at least, well, if not 10 years, at least say 8 years to work with.
Come on, because Warren Buffett likes to buy and hold. Come on, right?
I know that, but the point is, if you know what the rules are going to be for the next 8 years, you could actually make informed cost benefit calculations and decisions about the things that you're going to do.
I would agree with you. I think we've had this tendency to just extend things or just very short term as we kick the can down the road. And if you're an individual or a business and you want to make informed decisions about how you're going to put your money to work, whether it's through the investments in financial markets, or whether you're a business owner and you're making commitments on new capital projects, putting a new plant, new facilities, upgrading your technology, you need some clarity about what the world's going to look like before you're going to put that capital at risk.
Yeah, I mean, one reason why businesses aren't hiring as much as maybe people thought they would be by now is because business owners have to do a cost benefit. Every employee they hire is a cost. They have to be certain that the after-tax benefit of that exceeds the cost. It's impossible to actually project that right now.
I would agree.
Well, can we reflect on what Reagan did when he had some tax raising, revenue raising, and then Clinton had the Deficit Reduction Act. Would these types of things work today? Is that what they're trying to do, or do you have any opinions on those things?
Well, let's also remember when you talk about Ronald Reagan. Actually, Ronald Reagan, he probably sat and was the architect behind one of the largest tax cuts in history. Actually, up until President Bush, it was the largest.
Right, but he raised it about six times, and then there was a big
He did, but again, I think there was what the president was looking for, though, was he wanted to simplify the tax code. And, and of course, there are pre-steps you have to take to get there. But I think the end of the day was ultimately what was delivered. And remember, part of those tax cuts were at least partially responsible for the early part of the recession that we got in the early part of the Reagan era. So my view is that given where we are in terms of the business cycle and where this recovery is still on relatively fragile ground, I think it would be a mistake for us to simply allow the tax cuts to all expire en masse and just simply take that money out of the economy. I think it would be a shock. It's sort of like a bucket of cold water in the face that we don't need right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's already so much money out of the economy, at least in the world that I play in, the family office space. It's sitting on the sidelines.
Well, yeah, I mean, these aren't a lot of corporations. Don't they have billions or trillions on their balance sheets right now? How do we encourage them to invest in R&D and jobs and things like that? Is there what can we do about that?
Well, the first thing we do, Joe, I think I hate to tie everything back to taxes or everything back to regulation, but I always tell people if you give business owners in this country the playbook, they'll figure out how to win. If you keep ripping pages out of the playbook and putting new ones in, they're just not going to play anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of what a lot of business owners are facing right now, whether you're a large corporation or a small business owner, is a lack of certainty and lack of clarity. So the first thing we can do is give them a sense of what that world's going to look like beyond 6 and 12-month periods. Mm-hmm. And to the point Richard made before is he'd like to see some clarity over an 8 or 10-year horizon. I think that would do more to encourage investment spending and give businesses confidence about the money they're putting to work. They actually know what the environment's going to look like.
Is there a specific policy we could implement tomorrow, even if it's, you know, a 3 or 5 year plan or a 10 year plan?
Well, here's the problem with that. I think, you know, this whole notion that there's a single plan or that we can implement tomorrow, I think we've gotten a little bit too caught up in short-termism and that there's a one fix. I do think that whatever we're going to have to do with the tax code and the regulatory scheme, it's got to be fairly broad-based, because I think short-term one-off fixes just doesn't help. In fact, it sort of promotes this kind of very piecemeal approach towards solving our problems.
But I was just thinking of like one idea maybe to help companies insource, so maybe give them a tax incentive to do that, or to open up some manufacturing here.
I would probably say that there's two things we could do, I think, immediately to have an impact, a positive impact on business investment spending. The first is, when we talk about taxes, we're typically talking about the individual tax rate, personal taxes. The corporate tax rate the corporate tax code is every bit as Byzantine and antiquated and inefficient as the individual tax code. So the first thing we do is create a tax environment that's more business friendly for corporations. That would be the first step. I think the second also would be, look, you know, whether we believe all the regulations passed in the last 4 years were appropriate or not, we've had a lot of new regulation put on the books that some have been implemented, some haven't. Some have been interpreted and some haven't. I think if we get a little bit of regulatory relief after a flurry of new regulation, I think that would be a welcome addition to a number of policy steps we could take for business owners.
Hmm. Okay. Wow. Well, with that...
Good timing.
Yeah, Richard, we've got to take our long break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after new sports, weather, and announcements. So stick around. Right, we're back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life. We were talking so vigorously at the break here, we almost didn't get back in time, but here we are back.
But we should thank our sponsors, Joe.
Yes, we should. Well, you should.
One of whom, of course, is UBS. Michael Coronto is also in the studio with us. Absolutely. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Michael.
Also want to thank Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited, our favorite CPAs, Don Epic CPA and Paul Polito CPA with Polito Epic CPAs up in Vista.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Kruger and Signature Analytics, the best CFO practice in San Diego. Also, Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives. Rich Gaines and Family Legacy Legal. Rich is going to be on the show on November 11th, right after the election. Try to predict the future of the estate tax. And last but not least, the best business banker in San Diego County. That'd be Sean Puckett with Regions Bank. Thank you to all of the sponsors.
Mm-hmm. And Signature Analytics, did you mention that?
I mentioned Signature Analytics. That was when I said Jason Kruger.
Well, you know,
so now we'll say him twice.
You know how I check on these things.
I appreciate it.
Anybody can go on our website, iymoney.com, click on the sponsors page, and you can get all their contact information, and it's all right there, bios and everything else. So check it out, iymoney.com. A lot of good information there.
Well, so let me change directions with this fun little discussion. Michael, we've been talking about tax policy and the expiring tax breaks and sequestration and so on. Let me go over to the investment side. So you are the chief investment analyst for UBS. You must be spending a lot of time right now working with and mentoring and counseling wealth advisors for your company, because I would imagine the uncertainty makes it not that easy for them to be doing what they do. Am I right?
You are. We do spend a lot of time. We obviously, as we walk through the current scenario, the current environment, you know, first of all, we try and figure out where we're in the business cycle. It's always critically important. And then secondly, we have to figure out what price we're willing to pay for different assets. Are we appropriately pricing risk or mispricing risk? Are we seeing cash flows? Are they appropriately discounted or are they improperly discounted? So in this environment, when you have the uncertainty you talk about, Richard, it makes that job more difficult. It means that you have to spend more time because, for example, you were mentioning earlier about the fact that the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates so low. Well, obviously, that has an impact on pricing across all asset classes.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that there will be any clarity after the election, even though I said we're done talking about the election? Or do you think it's going to be at least a year before we have clarity, whether you call that tax clarity or just overall general clarity about what direction people might want to go with their asset allocations?
Well, if it's a year, then it's too late.
Okay.
We need clarity pretty quickly. Now, clarity doesn't mean we've solved all the issues and we have it tied up in a nice, neat ribbon. What it means is that, as I said from the outset, the short-term issues we have to address, because if we fail to address them, that could trigger a recession in the United States. And by the way, if we fall into recession, the odds that the global recession ensues is pretty high. So I think that's the most expedient thing we have to do is is really address that. But the longer term issues, we have to have a pathway to address it within a year. We can't be at the end of 2013 saying, oh, yeah, we'll eventually get to it. And here's why, Richard, because the rating agencies will eventually lose patience. Mm-hmm. If we don't address this, our credit rating becomes at risk. People become less confident in owning dollar-based assets, and that won't work in our favor. It hasn't cost us so far. The U.S. Treasury market has actually done well. People are willing to hold treasuries at this rate because of the safe haven status. But failure to address these fiscal issues in a thoughtful, deliberate, yet timely manner could jeopardize that safe haven approach, that the safe haven view that the U.S. has towards markets.
So what do you say to a client who's sitting, say, with $5 million on the sidelines without being specific with investment advice, who doesn't want to take much risk? What do you say to them?
I think what you need to do is you need to find engagement steps. So, for example, I think, people have said to me, well, I'm going to wait for the moment to get back in. And I've been in the business a long time, and I've rarely found the ability to pick an absolute top or absolute bottom in a market. So what I tell people is, okay, well, let's figure out an engagement process. Let's take a portion of the capital and let's perhaps put it into places where we think that the risk reward is better. For example, one of the things Joe mentioned in one of the breaks was the fact that, we have a more favorable view right now for the corporate bond market than we do for the equity market. It has lower volatility. We think that the risk premiums are still relatively high there. And it's a way of replacing some of the income that people have had to sacrifice as yields have come down. So I think there's some steps you can take to engage in markets without saying, okay, let's put everything in. Let's just put it in the riskiest part of the market.
And then you were going to talk about reflation a little bit as well, right?
It's interesting, Joe.
Yeah, can you define reflation? Because not all of our listeners probably know that term.
Sure. So if you think about what we're faced with right now, and we've gone through this shock. We had this bursting of a bubble, the credit bubble and the housing crisis. And basically when that happens, you usually have an economic crisis. And when the economic crisis ensues, one of the big risks you have is all this debt eventually has to be repaid. But if the economy is not doing well, then and you're not making money, it's hard to service that debt. So what you run in the risk then is you have what's known as a debt deflation, where prices start falling. People start liquidating assets because they're concerned about if they can, if they can meet their liabilities, or prices start falling further and then they liquidate them faster. And that's a very, very vicious cycle, and you want to miss that at all costs. Mm-hmm. So what central banks are engaged in right now is what I call the Great Reflation Sweepstakes. It's the Federal Reserve, it's the European Central Bank, it's the Bank of England, it's the Bank of Japan. They're all trying to pump liquidity into the system. Basically, they're trying to push asset prices higher to make sure that we don't fall into that debt trap, that debt deflation cycle.
Hmm. And how much of an impact does Europe have on that overall approach? You mentioned that this is not just in the U.S. that this is happening, but is Europe a key?
I think Europe is absolutely a key, but it's not the only place. If you think about this, the debt problems I talked about, if you think about it for a moment, it's a developed world issue. That includes the United States, it includes Western Europe, it includes Japan, and that this debt overhang means that our central banks have to step into the breach here and make sure that this debt problem doesn't build on itself. And then we have to have a plan or a pathway for dealing with the debt long term.
I think that makes sense.
How about this Governor Romney labeling China as a currency manipulator? I'm told they do this anyway, and in every election cycle, people will scream about it. But then after the election, there's really not much they can do. They hold a lot of our debt, don't they?
Well, first of all, I think the accusations of China being a currency manipulator, it's probably one of those rare things where it's a truly bipartisan approach. I think everybody in Washington, the Democratic or Republican side, sort of have a similar view. Here's what I think we have to understand about China is that, the China economic expansion and the fact that China has done so well over the course of the last decade or so has been built really on two things. It's been built on exports and infrastructure. They've made things and they've exported them to other folks. And what was key to that then was almost an approach where you had to keep your currency low to maintain competitiveness in your export markets. So that's been the process in China. And I think what's obviously it's done is it's led to these imbalances where we've been consuming too much and they've been perhaps producing too much. So one of the ways to correct that imbalance is quite frankly to see your currency revalue, to see the renminbi go higher, to see the dollar weaker. So I think that's really what Governor Romney and certainly other members of Congress have talked about as well, is the need to see the markets determine what the right currency exchange rate is and not being set by government officials.
Mm-hmm. And I think energy has been a big problem, don't you? I mean, these inflating gasoline prices, they're not going to go. They're only going to go one direction long term. I'm thinking as gas gets harder to produce. What can we do to address that?
So that's a complex question. I would say I'm not 100% convinced that gas prices only have one way to go. And in fact, I would argue that if you see a combination of increased exploration coupled with increased conservation, there's no reason to see why gas prices have to be as high as they are. We already know that there's new technologies that are being utilized every day that are now increasing the yield of existing fields. In fact, there were fields that had been thought to be depleted, and now we're finding out that they still have reserves as much as 30 or 40% of what they originally yielded. So I think there are incremental steps we can take. But let me throw one other thing out here, Joe, that I think is potentially a game changer. And when we talk about energy in this company, we obsess about oil because it's petroleum-based. But I think a game changer here, and I think you're starting to hear more about it, but you'll hear more about it in the next 5 years, is this whole notion about North American energy independence driven by the development of natural gas. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you can't go out tomorrow and put natural gas in your car. But what you can see over time is investments in infrastructure can wean you off certain types of energy and allow you to utilize other forms of energy. So even though in the very short term, natural gas and oil aren't perfect substitutes, as you develop your infrastructure, as you change, as you modify and you make technological advances, it means that a large portion of some of the things you're using right now that are powered by oil may be powered by natural gas in the future.
We have buses here that run on natural gas. We have, and there are, I did know at one time cars did. Oh, darn, Richard, we got to take another break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life. Stay tuned. All right, we're back in the home stretch for It's Your Money and Your Life, so I will get out of the way and let's get into some questions, Richard.
All right, well, we talked about taxes and we talked about debt or bonds. Let's talk about the equity market now. Not necessarily the most favorable place to be in some people's opinions, but the question is, well, I've been doing some reading. Do you think we're near the end of an earnings cycle? Let me just put it out that way.
Well, Richard, I think if you go back and you look at the last couple of years, we had a recovery in corporate earnings from the collapse we saw in the aftermath of the crisis. Remember, mm-hmm. we had this double gainer after the crisis hit and earnings collapsed, and therefore in the recovery period we basically had companies that have been posting double digit earnings gains. I think we're at the end of that.
Okay.
Because I think the earnings we've recovered towards trends. So I think what we're going to have to see going forward is a combination of things to drive corporate earnings. We're going to have to see some top-line growth. I mean, at the end of the day, you can't cut your way to prosperity forever. You need to have some gains in terms of the top line. But I do think that companies are still finding ways in challenging environments to still make money. So being efficient and raising productivity is part of it as well. So I think those two things together means that we're probably going to get earnings growth probably more in the mid to high single digits rather than the double digits we've had in the last couple of years.
And I know if you look at history, equities tend to do a little bit better under a Democratic administration, even though Romney obviously would be a little bit more favorable on the income tax as well as the regulation side. What say you about that?
I think that's true as an observation, but I'm not sure you can assign causation to it. I think it's a little bit misleading to say, okay, well, because they have in the past done better under Democrats, then a Democrat is destined to see better performance. In fact, I think what matters a lot more is what the macro environment looks like and what the policy options that are available to a president and to Congress look like. And to me, in the environment right now, and here's what I see in terms of the market right now. I think we're going to get okay growth, but it's still going to be that kind of middling 2% growth. So I think it does come down then to some of the policy choices. So this may be one of the environments where the path we choose does have a bigger than normal outcome impact on how the equity markets fare.
And so therefore, should investors maybe focus on certain sectors that might be considered more important, consumer staples, technology, things like that?
It's important you mention that because I think given how close the election is, I think some people have said to me, well, who should I pick if President Obama wins or if Governor Romney wins? I said, well, rather than do that, why don't we do the following? Why don't we look at the sectors that are less dependent upon the outcome? And one where we think that the fundamentals are better drivers. So, you just hit the two, Richard. Technology and consumer staples, they're not likely to be materially different under a Romney administration or an Obama administration. We actually think that For example, on the technology side, we think that technology is trading at some of the cheapest levels we've seen in 20 years, partly because some of the earnings misses we've seen more recently. But I think that the growth dynamic is still intact there. And I think consumer staples, look, this is one of those areas, the consumer staples area, where it is a longer-term play off of the expansion in prosperity, and especially in the emerging markets. So those are two sectors in particular that we think are less vulnerable or less dependent upon the outcome, yet we like those fundamentals.
Another question, in the family office world where I do a lot of business, we've seen somewhat of a disenchantment with what we call traditional asset classes. So we're seeing high net worth families invest in things like REITs or limited partnerships that are in the oil and gas space or other energy space, or partnering with other families that actually put deals together, say with distressed debt or distressed real estate. I know that's not really the business that UBS is in, but you certainly obviously work with very high net worth families as well. What are you seeing with very high net worth families?
Well, first of all, I think all of those options are things that we do look at. We do make recommendations that clients look outside the traditional asset set. I would say two things about it. First of all, understand the risks you're taking. And what I mean by risks is everyone also always assumes that it's about credit risk or volatility. It's also about liquidity. Mm-hmm. So you have to have the appetite for the risk, but you also have the capacity to accept the illiquidity that exists in some of these asset classes. I think the second thing I would stress, Richard, is it may be the best asset class. There may be the greatest return potential, but let's not over-concentrate. I still think you need to have diversification in your portfolio. As you know, the lesson my grandmother taught me, and I've relearned over and over and over again, moderation is always the best approach.
I always tell people, moderation. But yeah. Anyway.
So can't get enough of that moderation.
Can't get enough of that moderation. So we only have about 2 minutes to go. As I said, time flies when you're having fun, and we are having fun. So given all the uncertainty that we talked about in the equities market with regard to bonds, with regard to sequestration and the election and tax, what's the best advice you can give somebody right now who's listening to this show who's, let's say, is a high net worth individual or family?
I would say don't get overly obsessed with the short-term headlines. Look, if you think about it, over a longer period of time, if we extend our sights 2 or 4 years, what you typically see is that markets that are trading at the levels they're at right now, for example, the equity markets, it at these levels, does it usually pay off to have equity ownership? And the answer is yes. These markets are not exceedingly expensive. So what I would tell people is don't get so caught up in all of the short-term issues. Don't get so obsessed with the headline of the day or the news flash of the day. And let's start looking through this and start focusing on where we see value in markets, where there's opportunities. But at the same time, let's be careful that we're also balancing that with the risks. Because one of the things we didn't talk today about, Richard, was the fact that there's a risk that lies outside the equity market. And that is a risk that as rates start to rise, there's potential now for having an impact on the fixed income portion of the portfolio that most people are not fully aware of.
Yeah, and we've got a minute to go. So could you please explain or expound on that?
Well, if you think about it, you have treasury yields right now that are trading 10-year treasuries of below 2%. And there's a lot of money that's flowed into the fixed income markets for defensive purposes to capture incremental yield. Now, at some point, rates are likely to rise. It won't happen right away. But as capital demands start to recover, as the business cycle improves, as labor markets start to gain traction again, as the central bank starts to shift policy and inflation expectations start to turn, we're likely to see interest rates go up. Not all at once, and perhaps not sharply, but I do think that the risks for rates are asymmetrically biased towards the upside over the course of the next 5 years.
Hmm. Well, that's encouraging. Hey, we're getting at the point where our national debt and our public and our national deficit or our federal deficit are about equal, $16 trillion. How high is up for our national debt? I mean, it's going to get worried. I mean, isn't 40% of our budget now spent to service debt?
You know, it's interesting, Joe, because there's actually a wonderful book that was written by two economists, Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff, and they basically talked about, say, this time is different. And what they found is that when the debt-to-GDP ratio reaches about 90%, that impairs future growth.
Wow.
Now, we're right there. Now,
we're right there.
One caveat, Joe, is that remember that it usually happens with smaller economies that aren't the reserve currency, which we are.
All right, we'll have to get that book. But Mike Ryan, thank you very much for being here. Michael Quaranta, our in-studio guest, thank you. Richard, I'm glad you made it in.
Joe, thanks, Michael. And Michael, very much appreciated. Yeah, I'm glad I made it in, too.
Thank you, made it in. And thanks to Justin Hart on our board. And a speedy recovery to Craig Blanke, who's going in for double knee surgery Monday. He'll be out for several weeks, our account executive. Thanks to Dave Smith, our program executive. And you have a great week. We'll see you next week on It's Your Money and Your Life. Good night now.
for term life insurance? Well, I'm Joel Clark, a SelectQuote agent, with some good news. Now you can learn your best rates from ING, Transamerica, Banner Life, and many other highly rated term life insurance companies with just one phone call. That's right. At SelectQuote, one call shops them all. Give us a few minutes, and you could save hundreds of dollars. For example, a man 35 years old, in excellent health, can get a 10-year, $500,000 policy through SelectQuote for under $17 a month. Give us just one call and see how affordable term life insurance can be for you.
Call 1-800-900-1743. 1-800-900-1743. 1-800-900-1743. Or go to SelectQuote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at SelectQuote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
We follow the story.
Bob Filner would rather play politics than get San Diegans back to work.
Then we lead the conversation.
Carl can have his own opinions, but not his own facts.
Follow the leader. 760